I went to the first two General Assemblies before the occupation, and on the day of the occupation, I basically was asked to grab a microphone and be one of the two facilitators that kind of led the way, and it was an incredible experience looking out on between what I think 6,000 and 10,000 people, I don't know the exact number, and realizing this was way, way bigger than I thought it was. You know, I was expecting 400 or 500. I was expecting the typical Portland protest, and looking out at the sea of, you know, diverse backgrounds, really. Everything from, you know, houseless people to veterans to elderly, you know, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, all races. It was incredible.
Well, how did you... When you looked up and saw so many people, how did that did that rattle you at all, or encourage you?
I would say I'm a very comfortable public speaker, but when I did actually, I was actually facing into the smaller portion of the crowd and didn't realize it at the time. And then somebody kept telling me there were people behind me, and I turned around and it was just a sea of humanity. And I was just it, and that for about a split second I froze and I was like, I can't talk to this many people. this is a little bigger than what I'm used to, so.
Did you hand over the bullhorn at that time, or did you stick with it?
Yeah, there were two of us up there. It was, you know, I feel bad. I can't even remember her name right now. We were up there, and we were just trying to kind of facilitate, if you can call it that. I mean, we were having a little bit of trouble because, you know, about 3/4 of the crowd couldn't even hear us. It was that huge.
Right.
And but then the march kicked off, and it was awesome. We got here, and I think... Food Not Bombs had the kitchen set up that night, actually. Yeah. I think we actually had warm food that night. And so right away, the community got involved, people got involved, and, you know, over the next couple of days, committees got set up. And I honestly, you know, for the people that are out there in the Portland metro area right now, please don't read the newspapers and quit reading all that junk. You know, you have the perfect opportunity right now to come out and experience it. And, you know, you can meet the people who run KABU, you can meet veterans. And oh, you're showing me a picture right now. Yeah, that was
that's
a
you
lot
at
of
the
people.
Rally. Yep. And the girl in the red hat who you were referring to.
My partner there, yeah. No, you know, I just strongly encourage the community in Portland to get out here. I mean, there's absolutely no excuse not to. You know, cut out a TV show once a week or you know, make time. You know, revolutions just don't happen by themselves. Take that as, you know, that's a hint. You know, we need your help.
Exactly. We do need bodies down here. And I couldn't agree more about seeking other forms of media.
Definitely. Well, I got to return to my safety duties. So we need safety volunteers. So if you're interested, get down here and do safety.
That seems to be a more and more crucial aspect of this.
Yes.
Needing safety people.
I would say so.
All right. Thanks, Micaiah.
Well, definitely. It's a pleasure talking to you as always. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Okay. Now we'll return to some... Oh, sorry. Was that me or you? All right. So we're back. We're interrupting our broadcast of the other occupation stories. And right now we're going to interview... a representative from the Northwest Tibetan Cultural Association. We're getting him set up and comfortable. He's in the hot seat. You got his mic up. Beautiful. So, could you introduce yourself, please, and who you're with?
Sure. I am the coordinator for Tibet's program at the Pioneer Square House. It's part of the Northwest Tibetan Cultural Association. I'm Mi'kmaq Galnop. And we are having a program here today from 10 o'clock in the morning to 6 p.m., and our main program is from 12:30 to about 1:50. Now we are here today. Tibetans all over the world are gathered today to protest the Chinese occupation in Tibet, and especially the recent self-immolation that has been taking place in Tibet. The communist Chinese regime in Tibet is so repressive and so tyrannical that people have lost all their, you know, like patience and. A lot of youngsters from the ages of 17 to about 29 have, so far, 9 of them have self-immolated themselves, and out of them, 5 have died, and 5 more are in the, those who are, 4 of them who are not dead are in Chinese prisons, and they've been treated very badly. Now, we are here today, and it's done all over the world, to let the people in the world know that we need your attention, we need your help, so that people in Tibet have some democracy and freedom in Tibet itself and all over the world, and especially in China. So we are gathered today at Pioneer Square, and we are asking the international people and international world, all the communities in the world, to help us to, you know, end the repressive regime in China and at least have a freedom in Tibet. So for last 3-4 months, there's been many youngsters who have self-immolated themselves. And I tell you, it's not an easy task to self-immolate oneself. So what is this showing is that people are really, really desperate. And then a lot of things, you know, they're not self-immolating themselves because they're tired of the life of the sufferings of life. But they're doing it for the free nation of Tibet and for the well-being and the independence of Tibet and return of Dalai Lama to Tibet. So I request all the people in Portland, if they have time today, to come at 12:30 to about 1:50 at Pioneer Square House, and we will be talking about this, and we'll be distributing leaflets. And at 1 o'clock, Commissioner Randy Leonard will come and talk on the occasion. He's the chief speaker, and we'll have our community people speak and the Tibetan Youth Congress. And we are about 200 Tibetan people have gathered in the Pioneer Square House right now on the Morrison side. So we would all appreciate if you can come and support us. And we are doing an online petition, and we have a booth where you can do an online petition. So please help us. And I hope the cry of the Tibetan people will not go in vain, and we get international attention. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Oh, I just had a question. Where can we find the online petition?
Oh. We're getting the technical support from...
Tibetnetwork.org. Okay. So there's an online petition there, and there will be a gathering in Pioneer Square from 12:30 to approximately 1:50 with Randy Leonard speaking at 1 p.m. And so that's in solidarity with addressing the issues of Chinese occupation of Tibet.
Yeah, and there's so much repression that people have lost patience completely, and young, it's not the the Tibetan people who are, you know, who are born before 59. They are the product of Tibetans who were born under the communist regime. Right. And those are the people who are doing self-immolation are 17 years, 18 years, 19 years. That from 15 to about 29 years of age, that age group.
That age group.
The people doing it. And they're mostly nuns and monks. And all are monks, but one nun did on 20, just yesterday. Therefore, yesterday, one nun self-immolated herself. She died. So far, 9 people have done it. 9 people have done it, and they're out of all the 9, there's one nun. And 5 of them had died, but 4 of them are not dead. And the Chinese just know, while they were dousing the flame, and they were, you know, like punishing them, and they're all in prison. Some are in unknown location, some are in the county prison. And one of the who died, they did not even give the body to the family. They just, I don't know where they're buried, they never gave it back to us.
Right.
So the situation in Tibet is really critical, and we are drawing attention to the world. And today, all over the world, there's a protest going on regarding this issue of the self-immolation, and to say enough is enough. We need attention of the international to help us in this this direction.
Great. Well, thank you for bringing it to the
attention.
Thank
you. So that is there. I mean, thank you so much, guys.
Absolutely. Appreciate you coming down to say that.
Is there anybody whom I can talk here who can say, at least join us at 12:45 to about 1?
I would go to information right across the way there.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
You might be able to arrange
thank
something.
You so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for what you're doing. And, describing that situation, Tibet's so desperate, and they have no other recourse. They're turning to self-immolation just to get attention to this cause. So go to the online petition again at Tibetnetwork.org.
Hello, this is Anna Preble at the KVU radio booth here at the Portland Solidarity encampment in downtown Portland. And I just wanted to, I took note, it's 10 till 12 noon, so I just wanted to hop back on and make some quick announcements about what's happening at a little bit later this afternoon, including in Terry Shrunk Plaza, which is the amphitheater across from the encampment. There will be a 2 p.m. Veterans Committee meeting. So that's open to veterans who would like to get involved. And we just spoke to a a representative from the Tibetan community who is encouraging everyone to join him in a global-wide movement of Tibetans, Tibetan communities all around the world who are protesting the Chinese occupation of Tibet. And they will be gathering today at Pioneer Square at 12:30. And they plan to have a speaker, Randy Leonard, will be speaking at 1 p.m. And the Tibetan Youth Congress will be present. He mentioned the participation of many of the youth who are mostly in their 20s. And there's also an online petition you can find at www.tibetnetwork.org. So just wanted to quickly announce those things. And we're just chilling still at the camp, and it's a little bit cloudy today, so it's a little bit more subdued than it's been on these last few sunny days, but it's okay because we're all still here, we're all present, and
hey.
Hi, this is Anna Preble from the KBOO booth at the Occupy Portland Solidarity Camp in downtown Portland, and I just wanted to put our pre-recorded interviews on pause while we bring you an interview with a guest here at the camp booth. So,
great. Could you please start? What's your name and what do you do?
My name is Paul Bogdanich, and I work as a financial advisor in advising publicly traded companies how to not be mistreated by investment bankers and others that they deal with. So as such, I have been following banking changes in banking laws and particularly clearing and custody for the last 20 years.
Great. And so what brings you down here today?
I saw an interview yesterday with a gentleman, an economist by the name of Nassim Taleb on Bloomberg Television, where Mr. Taleb was very rightly concerned that these protests will get out of hand and possibly cost him his neck, and was of the opinion that this movement needs to be squelched, as I believe the term that he used, roughly as soon as possible. But when he was saying this, and he was also very critical of the administration and the administration's handling of the situation, I mean, he is an ardent critic of the increasing leverage, the corruption, and everything else. He was very plain on that. But when he was talking, Bloomberg Television was playing footage of violent riots that occurred in Athens and I think Italy. I couldn't tell precisely. One of them was definitely Athens, where the police were beating people, the protesters were throwing rocks, tear gas all over the place. And it, you know, to put in the public mind that somehow that the Occupy Wall Street movement is violent or dangerous, or potentially violent or dangerous, so that they can crush you with impunity, you know, so they precondition the population. Anyway, so knowing that you can't believe what you see in the press, I came down to the Solidarity encampment here and, you know, looked around and started speaking with people, right? And met one of the organizers, if there can be such a thing in a completely horizontal organization. But, you know, she just was a very helpful, very well-informed woman. And she called me today. I left my information. I'm not shy about who I am. You know? And she said, asked me if I would come down and speak to you.
Great. So you've been following, like you said, 20 years following the financial situation.
Yeah.
What have you noticed as the decline? Just bring us to the point where people have needed to... to voice this.
It's a very long story, right. And it starts with all people of Charles Schwab, of the Charles Schwab investment bankhouse. Back in the late 1990s, call it 1996 or 7, somewhere in that time frame, President Clinton was obviously in office at the time. He or the statisticians or the others at his organization noticed that the retail holdings of all of his customers essentially sat dormant. You know, I mean, people would buy stocks and hold them for years and, you know, without ever trading them and so on. And he came to the administration and he said that he would like to engage in a program that would accelerate trading volume and make the firm money, with which money they would use to lower the costs of trading to encourage even more trading, okay? You know, and but that it, technically it was against the law, okay? And that he had to have assurances that he would not be prosecuted under sections 10b-5 or 12 of the Securities and Exchange Act of 1932 or 33 as amended. And they did it. They gave it to him, right? You know, and it's essentially an informal waiver. Okay, they think that they're in a position to do that, right?
Okay.
You know, just waive the law.
So the law was still in effect.
No, it still is today, but okay. Nobody enforces it. But that's all right. But you know, they do this through lack of enforcement. Okay, the law is in place, and they'll use it on you. They'll use it on you. They'll use it on me. Okay, but this guy has an exemption, right? All right, and it spread. Other people similarly situated that ran bona fide organizations, E-Trade, Ameritrade, and so on, all used the same thing. So it was an informal exception for the law where he promised to do something quid pro quo, and he did what he promised to do. Okay, I would say that. And it increased trading volumes, and it got the retail public involved in the public markets, and then when they got involved in the public markets, they became a little bit irrational, as we saw happened in between 1997 and 2000, okay? And then, you know, you had the internet stock bubble and, you know, a variety of things, but, you know, all part of a calculated thing to get more retail participation based on an informal exemption from law given to somebody that ran a retail clearinghouse. In 1990, you know, that was the first instance of kind of them behaving like they didn't need to change the law. All they needed to do, you know, since they were the masters of, you know, I mean, you know, they can just wait it. Anyway, along comes Goldman Sachs. And this is somewhat later, 2004, 2005. The Secretary of the Securities and Exchange Commission at that time under George W. Bush was a guy by the name of Donaldson. And Mr. Donaldson resigned over this issue because he did not think it appropriate, but he never said why. You know, good little soldier, right? But anyway, Goldman came to the administration and wanted to use contractual codicils, which are terms of a contract, with all of their private clients and others that they do non-fully registered underwriting business with, to exempt themselves from the fiduciary obligations imposed by Section 5 of the Securities and Exchange Act of 1933 and 34 as amended. And they were given the exemption, and it quickly followed. And so in a lot of these investment banking contracts now, what you have is this specific exemption where they waive all fiduciary responsibility. Okay, mm-hmm. And it's only enforceable in the Second District of New York. Okay, all the contracts restrict it to the Second District of New York. So, in other words, they set up their court. Okay, they have a nice little justice system over here for them. Okay, and the other justice system that's out here is all for us, right? Okay, so but they write their contracts only whatever they call the word adjudicable in the Second District of New York, and they waive themselves of all Section 5 responsibilities. Now, you recently had, you know, and then they crashed the system because of these exemptions and the way that they behaved under these exemptions. There were no prosecutions and so on. It was with tacit approval of the politicians. Okay, so you have, after the crash, they haul Lloyd Blankfein, who is the chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs Corporation, in front of the Senate subcommittee. And one of the most earnest members of the Senate subcommittee, if there can be such a thing, Herbert Kohl of Wisconsin, gets into it, you know, a little bit with Goldman, you know, with Blankfein about a series of synthetic CDOs that they issued. Abacus, I believe, was the name that they gave them, you know, something of that nature. But and they kept arguing back and forth, and you know, what essentially Kohl was saying is you didn't live up to your part of the bargain, okay? And Blankfein said, yeah, well, you issued the exemption, you know, pound sand, right? You know, and so Kohl went back to his committee, and they formulated some charges which they forwarded to the Justice Department, but none of the charges included that the contractual waivers in all the Goldman agreements were contrary to existing law and should therefore be null and void. Okay, for example, if you and I enter into a private contract to do something illegal, okay, I'm going to steal electronic equipment, okay, and you're going to distribute it for me. Okay, and we come to an agreement where here's my cut, here's your cut, and we have a contract, okay, to do something that's illegal. No court in the world, except the Second District of New York, which is their court, not our court, okay, will enforce that because it's an illegal agreement.
So you're saying that this court, the jurisdiction is concentrated in the Wall Street area?
Yes, of course. Mm.
And then the rest of us have a different legal system that we have to abide by.
They set up a separate justice system, and they essentially exempted a whole class of people from, you know, existing law. And the misbehavior of said people, you know, caused a crash. And now they're kind of stuck. You know, the FBI. Okay, of all people. I mean, the FBI. These are not exactly what you would call reactionary liberals, okay? All right, the FBI in 2007 forwarded a report to the Congress that the mortgage industry was, you know, as they put it, an epidemic of fraud. Okay, and that's their words, not mine, in the, you know, the front page of the complaint.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, what did the leaders of Congress do upon receiving said report? They passed a law that stopped the then Attorney General of the state of New York, he was the Attorney General at that time, from pursuing further investigations against the mortgage industry. Okay, they made him stop. Okay, they also passed the legislation so that it covered all the other states. So in other words, they decided under another informal exemption not to enforce what the FBI, you know, found was blatant fraud. And furthermore, they passed a law that stopped all the state attorney generals from taking any action. They did what they did what the federal government or the courts call taking over the entire field.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then the mortgage mess happens and so on. And if you wonder why nobody goes to prison, is because the first time you prosecute one of these guys, he's going to bring up, hey, remember when? You know, I was acting on your authority, and you're going to be, you know, into the Nuremberg trials, right?
Mm.
You know, I only did what I was told, you know, and blah, blah, blah. All right, and so that's how come they're, you know, it's one of the main, well, I fully expected during the election of 2000 that with, you know, the 60-seat majority in Congress and the new president that we would not be where we are today. There were a number of things that they could have done at that point. He could have disavowed all the actions of Clinton and President Bush and prosecuted these people. It would have meant that Chris Dodd, Barney Frank, and other people would have, you know, lost all their seats in Congress, but whatever. Right? You know, no, he could have done a great number of things, and he was absolutely perfidious, didn't follow any of the things that he made, you know, promises or other intonations or suggestions that he made during the campaign, and he more than followed the Bush policies. And you have to ask yourself why. You know, it's convenient to believe that they're all corrupt or insane or something, and I don't mean to minimize that.
Right.
You know,
right.
Particularly the corruption. Okay, the campaign finance system in this country, in any other system, the lobbyists would be called influence peddlers, and the campaign finance system would be called graft. But because it's in America, we don't call it that, and neither does the international press, right? Okay, so, but you still have to ask yourself why. These people aren't stupid, you know. So why did they try and fix a problem of leverage with more leverage when they gave the banks, and this is, you know, an accurate figure, $16 trillion in terms of liquidity, whether in direct payments, repurchases of assets through the Federal Reserve, expansion of the money supply, or expansion of the balance sheet of the Fed, it totaled about $16 trillion. Okay, and leverage at that time, what they were bailing out was $600 trillion, which is ridiculous because the total world GDP is $60 trillion. So they had everybody, every coffee farmer in Brazil, you, me, everybody else, they had everything that everybody does levered 10 to 1. Okay, and to bail them out of the last crisis took $16 trillion in additional liquidity that they printed, which you and I pay for through higher inflation costs of food and fuel, which they don't count in inflation, by the way. But anyway, but you know, essentially the cost of commodities and fuel. The current leverage today is over $1,000 trillion, okay? $1,000 trillion is a term called a quadrillion.
Mm.
Okay, so the situation's gotten better, not worse. When it crashes again, instead of $16 trillion in what they call notional additions to the economic system, it's going to have to be somewhere in the range of 27 and 30, you know, to bail them out again. And they know that this is coming. They know that this is happening. And you have to, you know, you have people like Nassim Taleb, you know, worried about his neck trying to change the course on Bloomberg TV, which is actually quite extraordinary if you think about it. So you have to ask yourself why. You know, they're not stupid. They're not unintelligent. They may be have different priorities than you and I, and they might actually be evil. But, you know, but they're not unintelligent. You
right.
know, so what is it that they think that they're doing? Okay. And I don't know. You know, let me be the first to say that I don't know. But the only thing that makes sense to me, okay, as somebody who reads a lot and looks a lot and actually what happens, is if you, instead of viewing the banks as financial institutions, if you view the banks as a tool of empire, mm-hmm. okay, in other words, because our banks are the biggest in the world and because we clear all the monetary transactions in the world in dollars, and because we make everybody pay for their oil in dollars and so on, when we impose unilateral financial sanctions against a company or a country such as Iran, because we control the banking system, German industry, German banks, Chinese industry, Chinese banks, to a lesser extent, Russian industry, Russian banks, has to pay some attention to what we say or will impede their ability to trade in dollars, right? So if you look at the banks as a term, as a tool of imperial power, then it makes perfect sense why they would want to preserve that structure at any cost, even though, you know, and they recognize this. When you give them $16 trillion to do this, they stole 20% of the money. Mm. You know, they paid it to themselves. You know, in salary and bonuses.
The bonuses.
Yeah. You know, so they, and even knowing all that, they're still willing to put up with this to preserve that structure. And so what they're trying to do, in my estimation, is, you know, preserve the empire.
Then it definitely needs plenty of fundraising, right?
Well, but I mean, you know, it's you know, it's emblematic. There's wars all over the place. A lot of your, you know, what are we fighting? Four foreign wars. You know, global war on terror is a foreign war. Mm-hmm. Okay, that covers all your activities in Somalia and Yemen and Libya, or not Libya, excuse me, but Somalia and Yemen and other places across the globe that nobody's or seldom heard of. All right, then you have the action in Libya, principally at the behest of the Italians and the French, but nevertheless, the action in Libya. Then you have the Iraq occupation war, whatever you want to call it. And you still have the AFPAC, or Afghanistan-Pakistan situation. So we're involved in four foreign wars. Last I heard, he's thinking about getting involved in Central Africa, right? You know,
yeah. The sub-Saharan.
Yeah, and I'm just saying, so they're going all in, mm-hmm. if you will, to preserve the empire, and it gets worse every day. Yesterday, for example, October 18, 2011, that was yesterday, it came to the public's attention, printed by Bloomberg, by the way, but Bank of America announced results, and as part of announcing results, they had to publish their financial statements, okay? And so when the financial statement comes out, you know, you got a thousand different people all over the world, you know, pouring through the financial statements to look for details and what they did and whatnot. And they took a portion of their derivatives book, you know, which are these, you know, that $1 quadrillion worth of absolutely worthless leverage paper, and they put it in the holding company that has the commercial deposits. Okay. They won't say how much, because people immediately ask, on their books, they have something like $53 trillion. That's, you know, I mean, there's no way to settle that amount. It's, you know, it's gross. It's obscene. It's,
yeah.
It doesn't serve any purpose. It's, you know, that's what should have been contained, and instead they're expanding it. But anyway, they put some portion of that at the behest of a large client, and the only large client they have that has that much political power would probably be BlackRock, you know, who does all the cash deposits at brokerage houses. They clear through Merrill Lynch.
Are they also in New York? In the New York area, in that same district?
Bank of America is technically out of Charlotte, but I mean, they all report to the Federal Reserve and are owners in the Federal Reserve system and so on. But I mean, they commingled risk assets with deposit accounts. Okay? So if anything happens to those risk assets, unless you absolutely abrogate the laws of the country, the deposit assets are tied up along with them. Mm-hmm. Okay, now all the deposit assets are insured by the federal...
The FDIC.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the head of the FDIC, it now comes to light, okay, Sheila Bair, mm-hmm. announced her departure at just about the time they gave this 23A exemption to Bank of America. Okay, so she obviously disagreed with the chairman of the Fed who wanted to give the exemption. And the only person who could have made that decision and overruled her and had her go away would be the president.
Wow. Are you talking about Ben Bernanke that was...
Say again, please?
Ben Bernanke that did that, made the decision?
Mr. Bernanke is the current chairman of the Fed, yes.
Okay. And then Obama... And she just resigned, huh?
I can't remember. She announced her resignation 6-9 months ago, but this exemption was given in March of 2010.
Oh, see,
we're just now hearing
but,
about
but
it.
But this last quarter is when they first took the very bold step of moving risk assets in with the deposit accounts.
Right.
You know, so they had the exemption before, but they never took derivative contracts and put them in the holding company with the retail deposits.
Mm-hmm.
That just happened sometime in between... June 30th, 2011, and September 30th, 2011. So, you know, that just came to light. But I'm just saying, you know, this is not me, saying this, that I suspect this. You know, this is Bloomberg News, right?
Mm.
You know, and it's all very arcane, and they count on the fact that nobody will read it or listen to it, and even if they do, they won't understand it. But the broader point that I would like to express... the movement here. You know, firstly, I appreciate what you're doing because the only way to solve this is to get people talking to one another instead of through the news. We have to take these guys out of, you know, the filtering positions that they hold and start talking to each other, you know, directly.
Okay. Right.
You know,
right.
That's really, you know, but since it's fairly clear that these people have made the decision without consultation to us, you know, knowing full well in advance that we would probably disagree, that they're going to preserve the empire at any cost,
mm-hmm.
right? Because, and there's legitimate fears, you know. I mean, when we had, you know, the height of empire occurred probably in 1969. You know, you can't say. I mean, 500 years from now, some scholars will come to a definite conclusion. But,
yeah.
You know.
Right.
You know, somewhere, you know, but we were clearly in decline starting in 2003 with the Iraq War. Okay, so sometime before that.
Yeah.
But in 1945, when we carved up the world, okay, and, you know, made a lot of borders that didn't exist, Czechoslovakia, you know, the Czech Republic and Slovakia, that used to be a country called Czechoslovakia,
yeah.
right? And that was one of the causes of the First and Second World Wars. You know, and so on. The new countries of, you know, Georgia, Belarus, Moldova, you know, and so on when the Soviet Union, Croatia, Slovenia, I guess they still call it Yugoslavia, Montenegro, Albania, out of what was the former Yugoslavia.
Right.
You know, so we're not averse to changing borders, but we did some things that, you know, were kind of in our interests at the time.
Yeah.
We took over all the islands in Korea because we had the only boats. Okay, so there's all these islands up in the north part of Korea that rightfully, by any international standard, belong to North Korea and not South.
Mm.
Okay, but we've been enforcing that they're South Korean territory for the last 50 years simply because we have all the boats and that's what General MacArthur said. Right, great. You know, so I mean, you know, we've just been enforcing that through our imperial power. The independence of Taiwan, which we also give a great deal of business and loaded up with all our semiconductor manufacturing and so on. You know, I mean, Taiwan is about as far away from the Chinese mainland as Cuba is from us, and look at how we treat Cuba, so draw your own conclusions.
Yeah, and they don't have any diplomatic status anywhere.
Yeah.
There's no embassy of Taiwan. There's it's just appease the situation,
It's a protectorate.
Yeah.
Okay, and we also enforce mineral, fishing, and other rights in particularly the South China Sea, the Philippine Sea, that the Chinese, quite frankly, don't think are appropriate, to put it mildly. Then we, of course, have the geopolitical situation that we cause and continue to aggravate in the Middle East. And it's these imperialists' concern that if somehow we were to back off like we did in 1974 after the Vietnam War, or as the Russians did when their thing fell apart, that regional conflicts in these areas to settle these disagreements that were formerly kept in check by American imperial power would be calamitous. Okay, and that's their opinion. Okay, and I don't mean to sound fatalistic or whatever, but their opinion in the short term is probably going to prevail. Okay, and they're not. I can't see how they have a high probability of success, in my estimation. So I think we should start thinking about what we're, you know, going to do. In, you know, when the inevitable reactions to the declining imperial power come, I mean, you know, they'll try and start a much broader war. Probably.
Well, yeah, I mean, to keep that kind of stability, you know, you're overextending yourself, and the money is just going to thin out.
Well, there is what happened to the Russians at the end of the Second World War. You were essentially had two large empires.
Yeah.
You had the Soviets, and you had, you know, the Americans, and each one was trying to support a bunch of extraterritorial acquisitions that did nothing but cost money and manpower and time.
A lot of people just argue that the Soviets simply caved first before we...
Well, I mean,
it was just basically a game of chicken that, you know, and they ended up losing it because they ran out of time. Yeah.
Look,
who knows?
I have great respect for the fact that they wound down their empire without massive bloodshed.
Yeah, because that is kind of the nature of political change.
But they wound down their empire without any large slaughter of civilians, regional conflagrations, or anything of the sort, right?
Yeah.
Right. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are we going to do the same?
That's a big question, isn't it?
Yeah. It's,
you know.
Well, given our current policy of droning everything.
Extrajudicial murder, yeah.
Right.
Cultural atmosphere of... We are not going to give up our Second Amendment rights, and you know that you hear from some groups of
the
population. It's
but
it's
I mean
a
some
you know?
kind of broader discussion about the necessities of empire, what we're doing to maintain it, is it worth the cost, and what are our alternatives?
Mm-hmm.
In my view, would be enormously constructive because at least, you know, by statistical probability, just looking historically, these guys are going to run it into the ground. You know, they're not going to back off. They're not going to change. You're going to get some other president that's going to follow exactly the goddamn same policies. You know, excuse my language or something. You know, I mean, I hope not. I honestly hope not. And there's a lot of things that can happen, and maybe it will, and maybe it won't. And nobody knows. You know, but I mean, the odds are probably more that they'll continue to run this thing into a ground to a point where one day you wake up and you can't pay the soldiers, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's all gone.
Or the contractors.
Yeah, well, that's what happened to the Russians.
Yeah.
Right.
What are your thoughts on the leadership, Obama's leadership with the influence of Timothy Geithner as his Secretary of Treasury, considering his affiliations? I mean, that's a big loaded question,
well,
is it not?
I just don't. I'm trying to. The truth is rather insulting.
Okay.
In my view,
right.
Again, one of the other innovations of Goldman Sachs, starting approximately some 15 years ago, is they started doing detailed psychological profiles on applicants to the firm. And for people that were selected to, and this quickly spread to other banks, I mean, the people that paid for the psychological research and pioneered it were, you know, was Goldman Sachs. And so they hire people that are susceptible, if not borderline, what psychiatrists argue is either a personality trait or a disorder called narcissistic personality disorder, or NPD. And the chief trait of NPD is you define yourself by your contact with others. Okay? Your self-identity is affixed by who your friends are, who are the people that you work with, and so on.
Yeah.
So you're very much a groupie, if you will. It's a trait that's existed throughout history. The Romans used it to protect Roman rule. It was the sole basis of the relationships in between the sovereigns and the monarchs. you know, all through the historical monarchy period, right? And so this is a human trait, which is why there's some argument about whether it's a diagnosable psychological condition, but it's clear that some people have more of a propensity to that than others. So anyway, they get these people, they hire them, they tell them they're the brightest and the best, which means that if you associate with anybody else, they're the dumbest, right? You know, so what are you doing talking to those guys for, right? Talk to us, you know, and stay in this circle of friends. And then they arrange for their women, they keep track of what drugs they do, whether they're homosexual, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and they just create this very tight community, but even in some cases it takes, okay? And the person involved has their identity, their very central identity. They just can't imagine. It's incomprehensible to them. A world without that class of people running things. It's incomprehensible to them, right? And so for reasons that they probably couldn't even explain themselves, you know, that's how they act when push comes to shove. Okay, so you take those people and you put them in key positions.
And getting back to the original question,
where did Timothy Geithner go?
Right.
He plays the game, huh?
Yeah, and I mean, but there's a whole pool of these people to choose from, and some of them we elevate to politics, and some of them the current head of the IMF that steps in after, not the IMF, excuse me, the European Central Bank, all right,
oh, okay.
The next guy, he's an Italian, but he's the same thing, you know, Goldman Sachs, you know, managing director. As I recall, but so the next, you know, after Jean-Claude Trichet retires, which I think happened today, in fact, Mario, I can't remember Mario's last name, but Mario is the new head of the IMF, and he's a Goldman person. And so, you know, what can be expected out of him? You know, this is roughly the same thing that Timothy, you know, that we've done here, which is solve a problem of leverage with more leverage, you know, back, you know, from 0.6 quadrillion all the way to one, you know. And so on. So it's, you know, they're going to pursue the maintenance of the system as they see it for the reasons that they see it. And I think in order to avoid some potentially really nasty business that happens, you know, when they ultimately fail, that people need to start looking at it, you know, in those terms, you know, because everything, you know, I mean, everybody here, if you ask anybody here why they did this, what you get is anger. Why'd they do this, right?
Yeah.
They're stupid. They're corrupt. They're, you know, they're just, you know, in they're bought and paid for by the... But a lot of that's true. I mean, I don't mean to minimize it. I mean, a lot of that's very true. But they're not stupid. Okay, so what's the general framework that they're all operating under? And I would just argue that it's, you know, preservation of empire. But when you do that... And then the empire goes away, your historical examples, you know, this is why they're all, excuse my language, you know, peeing down both legs over what's happening in Europe.
Right.
All right, you know, because, you know, European and Greek society and Spanish society are very different than our societies. And, what, you know, and the Italians are quite remarkable in how... easygoing, you know, they are. They suffer a lot. You know, they suffered fascism. They weren't really on board with it like the Germans were, but, you know, they suffered it. But, you know, they don't care. You know, let Mussolini, you know, if Mussolini runs things and it's working all right for, you know, our little town, you know, fine. You know.
Yeah.
And, you know, they do that, and they, you know, probably because, you know, their entire history going back to, well, 90 BC?
Yeah, like the Bronze
Well, no,
Age.
I mean, first they were ruled by the Romans, then they were ruled by the Catholics, you know, and then, you know, you had the hereditary monarchies, and then you had the fascists, and now you have, Mr. Berlusconi and the, special democratic system that they have. But, I mean, you know, so, I mean, they've always, you know, the point I'm making is they do not have the aversion to charismatic leadership figures that we do in the United States. Okay, nor do the Spanish. Okay, nor do the Greeks, nor do the Germans, okay, nor do the French, really, but France is a little bit different situation. The Nordic countries, you know, the Laplanders, as they say, have an absolute aversion to that kind of thing.
Yeah,
always
they
have.
Seem to run on a different speed.
You know, but I'm just saying, but so these people are very, very concerned that, you know, because this situation is global, because of all that leverage that they fail to control and keep expanding, you know, they're worried that either the Greeks or... the Spanish or the Portuguese or, you know, somebody flips and says enough. You know, enough austerity, enough of this, enough of that. You know, back out of the international agreements, refuse to pay the leverage bets, come in with their own currency and make life better for their own people, and that would be an absolute unmitigated disaster for these guys, right?
Right.
And, you know, the concern has to be very valid. I mean, Angela Merkel, I mean, no matter what you think of American politicians, she is not a narcissistic, insane individual. Mm. A woman who grew up in East Germany, very centered, married to the same man, a college professor who doesn't like the crowds for 50 years. And I mean, she's just, you know, incredibly bright. She has a concern that Europe could disintegrate. And so she's doing some things that seem highly irrational. It's unclear whether she'll get away with them because her parliament does not agree with the solutions that are essentially imposed by, you know, the IMF and the Americans, who solve leverage with more leverage.
Yeah, and so yeah, on. That was definitely a hard decision she had to make this last week concerning the euro and the the system of, trying to keep things stable over there economically. I mean, that's
if they collapse, you know, the problem is the leverage.
Yeah.
And they did, you know, you have to ask yourself, you know, they did it because it was politically easy, it was convenient, it allows the bank guys to keep stealing more, but it causes increased fragility and volatility in the system. Mm-hmm. And not only did they not contain it, which is what they should have done in 2008, I would also point out, there was a company called Automotive Parts Supplier, and it wasn't AC Delco. It was, anyway, I don't remember the exact name of the parts supplier, one of the GM subsidiaries that was spun off, and they went bankrupt in George Bush's term of office, I think in 2004. They had $2 billion, with a B, which is a goodly amount of actual money, $2 billion in bonds, which is hard money. Somebody paid a dollar for each dollar on the bond, you know, less yield, what they call, you know, the subtraction of the interest over the term of the bond. But and $2 billion worth of bonds, and at that time they had $22 billion, which is, you know, 110% of derivatives written against the $2 billion worth of bonds. And they went upside down. And the bankers came to the Federal Reserve and the president's office like they did in 2008 and said, we need the liquidity to handle this. And much to George Bush's credit or whoever, you know, he said, get out of here. You know, you guys are big boys. Go handle that yourself. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
How did they handle it when it was their money that was at risk? Okay. They were actually in the situation where they had a defaulted company and the leverage was so much that it couldn't be cleared, and it was their money that was going to have to make up the shortfall, not the taxpayers' money, okay? So what did they do, these same people, when it was their money at risk and not the taxpayers, okay? They canceled trading in all the obligations, said stop, count up what you have, show up here, and they set a meeting. Okay, at, you know, one of the convention halls in New York. And everybody with either CDS obligations or derivative obligations or the actual bonds themselves showed up at the meeting. Without adjudication, without recourse, and without settlement, they immediately canceled all the offsetting obligations. If I had the bonds here, but protection against them over here, or if I was short this contract and long that contract, and the contracts were identical, they immediately netted all those to zero. And the guy, you know, the guy could complain, well, I was holding them at a gain, and they told him tough, you know, tough. The company went bankrupt. We can't settle them. They just netted them all, you know, for notional amount. Okay, they, you know, which is what the guy, you know, what they said on the face value of the instrument, immaterial of, you know, quote unquote, their actual worth, if any. But they, you know, they netted them all at notional amount. They had some amount left over, which was only about 8% of the total. That's how corrupt this system is. It's just pieces of paper flying all over the place.
Yeah.
And then they took that 8% and they settled against the assets of the corporation. Right?
Right.
Very simple. Done in a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And they had to kick in a couple of bucks. You know, but not, you know, not, you know, nothing severe.
The payoff was better.
Yeah. And so what did we do? You know, what did they do when, you know, when they were the ones on the hook for the bankruptcy? They came to the, you know, I mean, $16 trillion from you and me.
Right.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, you know, I don't, you know, I mean, if you, you know, we're a very well-trained population, and the media is absolutely responsible for, you know, a lot of the problems. But, I mean, you know, campaign finance reform, very strict. The power exists in the Constitution to strip jurisdiction from the Supreme Court, you know, on certain issues. I mean, the founders kind of foresaw that as a problem.
Okay.
All right. You know, so, I mean, you could say money does not equal speech, period. Supreme Court, you don't have any jurisdiction over that question, period. Sorry. Yeah. You know, go give right. speeches to think tanks, you know, but you're not deciding the issue. Right.
Right.
Okay. You know, and they could, you know, they could, you know, we could do theoretically do something like that, but how you can get a coherent message out to people in this media environment is, well, it's your challenge.
Good point. That's you why know, we so, are doing this.
Yes,
yeah.
But it's, you know, it's very difficult. You know, you have some very strong support. I mean, you have Paul Jay over at The Real News, you know, and, you know, some, you know, a lot of other independent radio and so on. So, I mean, you know, there's good things happening, and hopefully it won't come to tears, but you know these people are bound and determined to preserve empire.
Yeah.
And you can, and so it's best to be always keep that in your mind when you see something that's inexplicable. Try and think about, well, why, you know, how does this fit into that? And you usually kind of can see, you know, a little bit more while they're why they're doing some things, in my estimation.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Paul, for
yeah.
for sharing your thoughts with us. And
anyway, support the, you know, support you guys. Somebody has to do something, or we're going to wind up in a hell of a mess.
Right. Yes. Exactly. Even if the only thing that comes of this is gets people talking, then it's success as far as I'm concerned.
Or just thinking in a little bit broader terms, that would be very helpful.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I mean, hopefully they won't rush into the next war. Eh?
Right. Thanks again. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Broadcasting live from Occupy Portland.